It's time at TalkZone for more world-changing leadership with Our Global Hope. Here again, your host, Dr. Henrik Mann.
Well, we're back with our guest, Charlie Self. I'm Dr. Henrik Mann, and I want to remind our listeners that we're welcoming you to this new year and this new decade with a special interview to discuss the issues of war and peace and nonviolence as a basis of thinking about the past year and looking at President Obama's speech and then looking forward to the next, what the next decade would hold. This show is premised on the idea that there's a deep urge around the world for leadership that is based in truth, in love, and in nonviolence, and that we don't get a lot of that, and that we as people in the grassroots level should be pursuing that kind of leadership and supporting that kind of leadership. Charlie, I want to ask you to think with me about whether President Obama reflects fairly on the movement of nonviolence and on just war theory. He uses them as a way to support his idea that it's okay to use force in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And I'm wondering if you think that those war activities fit the definition of a just war theory, and whether he's reflecting fairly on the movement of nonviolence that has taken place around the world.
Well, what a great question, Henrik. I will say this. Just war theory in its full form speaks of war as being defensive, as being measured, as minimizing what we call collateral damage, having defined ends, having a very clear justification. And I would have to say that the conflicts we have faced since 9/11 tend to muddy the waters a little bit. The United States and other nations have been attacked, but we've not been attacked by a sovereign nation with soldiers wearing uniforms. We've been attacked more subversively with terrorism. And so I would say this, that the use of force may be a necessity in certain situations, but I think the more intelligent way forward, not only for America, but for all of the various civilizations under attack by those who are misusing their religion and have an agenda to subvert our freedom, would be a specific, measured response, seeking out and trying to bring justice to the exact perpetrators, as opposed to being occupiers in a foreign land. More easily said than done. Now, back to Barack Obama's speech, he is of the conviction that because there are terrorist headquarters in Afghanistan, that legitimizes the kind and use of force that we have there. Certainly, the ability to find and root out those who are perpetrating war against civilians and against freedom is a worthy cause. The problem is no one has ever conquered Afghanistan. No one will ever pacify those territories, whether they're Mongol, Russian, British, or even contemporary Western powers. So the best we can hope for in most of these contemporary conflicts is to be able to respond to the specific groups that are perpetrating the violence. And the worst thing that America or NATO or any power could do would be to be misperceived or be perceived as an occupying colonial force. It only reinforces the cycle. Nonviolent alternatives are very hard when there isn't a conscience in the opponent. Gandhi admitted that he could probably not have done what he did in India had he been faced with a Hitler or a Stalin. Martin Luther King, our great hero of nonviolence in the 1960s, knew that he could strike a deep chord of conscience in the American population, that no matter what their prejudices, they knew somehow that violence against humankind was wrong and preventing people from voting was wrong. So I think the challenge, Henrik, as we look at the global conflicts, is how do you stand up nonviolently to an opponent who does not share some of your common values?
I think you make a great point about the appeal to conscience. I just would like to maybe take this moment to share with our listeners that in modern industrial democracies, nonviolence has been used extensively, and I'm quoting from an article, by political sectors without mainstream political power, such as labor, peace, environment, and women's movements, but lesser known is the role that nonviolence has played and continues to play in undermining the power of repressive political regimes in the developing world and in the former Eastern Bloc. Susan Ives, for example, emphasized this point with a quote from Walter Wink, where she says, in 1989, 13 nations comprising 1,695,000,000 people experienced nonviolent revolutions that succeeded beyond anyone's wildest expectations. If we add all the countries touched by major nonviolent actions in our century, Korea, the Philippines, South Africa, the independence movement in India, the figure reaches over 3 billion people, a staggering 65% of humanity. All of this in the teeth of the assertion endlessly repeated that nonviolence doesn't work in the real world. Charlie, hasn't the world been deeply affected by nonviolence?
Absolutely, and you've reinforced the point I made just a few minutes ago. If you look carefully, the nonviolence was able to strike a chord both internally. Several of the nations you mentioned, they were revolutions, but they were revolutions within a nation, appealing to the best conscience of that nation. And so I would argue that we have historical precedent, we have biblical testimony, we have secular research, we have any number of affirmations that vigorous, active, nonviolent, not only protest, but assertion of truth, subversion of false power, etc., that it really does work. We also, though, have those anomalies and those moments in history where without the shared conscience, without the ability to build a bridge, you see, the key to nonviolence is that you build a bridge of trust and love and value with your enemy. The most exciting example of nonviolence recently was the change of regime in South Africa. And Walter Wink himself was deeply involved in that. Thousands and thousands of people worked on this with the Peace and Reconciliation Commission. President Mandela lost his marriage and lost the radical fringe of his own party because he refused to bring a retribution, but instead sought peace with the former apartheid leaders and some of the perpetrators. So it takes great courage, great conscience, but it takes that bridge. And so I would argue that President Obama is attempting to say there are times for that nonviolent. In fact, they're the preferred modality. And then there are the extraordinary situations where that may not work. I think he's trying, you know, the nonviolent wing would say he's compromising by going to war at all. Some of the very, very conservative folks who are suspicious of nonviolence because they see it as a euphemism for leftism, they see him trying to play it both ways. But in fact, in the real world, both have effect.
Well, Charlie, my sense is that just as a human being, when I read President Obama's speech, and you know, sometimes we just have to share our hearts, and we may not have all of the academic wisdom and understanding of history, but there comes a point where we just say in our hearts, why can't somebody stand up for nonviolence? Why can't we start leading with a heart for people and recognize that there are thousands and thousands of human casualties that come from war, and that maybe these wars are not justified, and maybe that there comes a time where it becomes almost obscene to hear an American president saying that he is willing to accept a Peace Prize award, when in fact underneath that rhetoric is the reality that he is increasing the war machine, and that he's, after 8 years, that we're continuing this involvement, and that there's no end in sight.
Well, I think you've hit something very important, and I think where we make the mistake is we assume that the nonviolence has to start at some kind of top-level position. It starts with Christians, Muslims, Jews, and non-religious people in America deciding to eschew violence and talk to each other, to live with our deepest differences, and in fact not stop trying to convince each other of our truth, but to live freely and lovingly even while we argue different things. It starts with our relationships with our neighbor. I was on a plane just last week, a wonderful man, and he said, you know, peace starts with me deciding to be your neighbor. And I think we fail to see that if today thousands of Americans said, I'm going to go and try to make a friend of someone that I view as the opposite side, I'm going to go and I want to actively make peace. It means challenging adherents of all faiths or none to make peace with people they perceive as their enemy. That's where it's going to start, Henrik.
Well, it seems, though, that people's minds are directed, guided, and moved in a certain direction when they see the powerful symbolism of the Nobel Peace Prize, which maybe it's a good prize, maybe it's not, because in some cases there can be serious questions about whether people deserve it. But you would think that even President Obama admitted his humility, that he didn't feel this was based on his accomplishments but on the hope that the world has for peace. And I appreciated that about his speech, but I found it painful to consider that as a leader, as a speaker, that he would use high-minded thinking about hope and love and faith, that he would reflect on the Christian tradition and use it as rationale for continuing to be involved in war, rather than to just put a line in the sand and say, look, these people have got to solve some of their own problems themselves, and that it's time for Americans to take these massive resources that we're pouring out on war and to use them to help heal America, where there's plenty of poor, where there's plenty of people who are struggling right now with a terrible economic sense of destiny. Charlie, don't you think we should be speaking hope into people's hearts?
I think so, and I share, and I'm a fairly, if you haven't figured out already, Henrik, and those of you listening to our Global Hope, I'm a fairly conservative guy, but I would be most in favor, I would be much in favor of bringing home our troops from as many lands as possible, judiciously and carefully, in agreement with our allies and friends. I want to see American military force used defensively, used to strike at the heart of terrorism or to help our allies when needed. But if we could just remobilize and redeploy the tremendous material and personal assets that we put to war use today, we could rebuild our infrastructure, we could provide the education and health care, we could do so many things, and we could even do it more cost effectively and more intelligently as well. So you and I share that kind of practical perspective as well. And it's not a matter of capitulating to terrorism or letting violence win, but it's really having a clear policy and strategy for when the nonviolent has to become violent and for what those conditions are and what the necessary response would be.
Well, I guess I would argue that we haven't met those conditions going forward, and that excuse me, that we have a lot of work to do to deal with our own house and our own foreign policy issues. I think this would be a good time to go to a second break. I want to remind our listeners that you can learn more about our show at www.ourglobalhope.com. And we'll be right back for more of Charlie Self and more world-changing leadership talk.